Thursday, the 27th of January. I knew that the route selected for my return journey would not be the easiest, being different to the route I'd taken up the Lujan. But varied and exciting it was certainly to be, how much so I did not know as I set off in the early morning, arriving at my first stop by 8 o'clock after some 30 minutes by motorboat, a trip upstream that was quite pleasant. Arriving, as I say, at the log camp, all situated on the river, quiet, no available transport, so just sat back and waited, an aspect of travel very common in this part of the world, requiring the traveller to have plenty of time on hand. It certainly does not pay to be rushing. Eventually, in the early afternoon, about 2 or so, I was awakened from a midday slumber by the noise of the transport. Yes, I gladly offered what was demanded in terms of payment, and off we headed. Well, this was on the back of a Land Cruiser. It was very difficult to describe the passing scenery as we headed off along Noggy Camp roads, but to say that it was definitely different. The route taken seemed to be along the ridges of various mountains or in valleys below, never anywhere in between. There was mud everywhere, and it was interesting. Definitely a little bit more than interesting to note a bulldozer from 2/3 covered with mud. Yes, it seemed to have lost its traction somewhere along the way and gone down a bit of a slope off the road, resulting in one of its tracks being completely covered in mud and the other being mainly covered. It was definitely going to take somebody a lot of work to pull this one out. The scenery, beautiful and wild. Yes, easy to say wild. Because you felt that there we were heading through this part of the world, and there did not seem to be anybody else around, other than the vacant driver of the bulldozer. The trip was more like a giant roller coaster with some 45 to 55 degree slopes up and down along ridges. Fortunately, we had four-wheel drive, otherwise, I think we too would have ended up in some valley below. Beautiful, untamed, or as nearly tamed, scenic views. Mud, always a problem. Eventually, about 4 or so arrived in the logging camp, central logging camp, built around a central area where, into the early hours of the evening, about 8, 9 o'clock, our vehicle continuously loaded and unloaded trucks of their recently plundered lumber. English was definitely a rare commodity in this part of the world. I sat back to watch the other people working, returning from work, and the day drove to a close. There's very little else doing this, but I would think that it would certainly drive any sane person mad after a short period of time. But there was an air of tranquility about it, despite the roar of the loud, noisy engines. The following morning, after a heavy night of rainfall, what little was left of the roads were now a bigger sea of mud. Another Land Cruiser arrived. Again, English or rarity, and then the back of it, off we headed towards the river point. Yes, the slippery, the sliding, wandering world, covered in mud, I would say by the end of an hour, I wasn't covered in mud, only partly splattered in mud, to be honest. Eventually arriving at this little harbour, a boat arrived shortly afterwards, one of these express boats which I referred to earlier, a smaller one, to take us downstream. It was at this point that, waiting the boat hovering next to the jetty, sloping jetty, about to throw my rucksack on, I noticed that my rucksack was not going on the boat, but was going in the river. Why? Was not the explanation. But I watched for a few minutes as my rucksack bogged up and down to the top of the water. Eventually retrieving it without decapitating myself, I wonder what would have happened if it had actually gone under for good. It could have been a blessing sometimes to start off with an empty rucksack. Anyway, all the content seemed to remain dry, as we subsequently found out, and off towards the little town of Bentulu, a town whose wealth was based on the nearby tree industry. Yes. On the way down, far too many frustrated trees lying on barges, or walls, or in some sort of Jackie awakens with the final departure via the two Zonos. The only other noteworthy feature of this trip is the rejuvenated waterfront, a very typical type of Sarawak activity by all accounts in Bintulu. Not much to do in Bintulu, definitely. A quick trip up the road to Batania and its more famous cave, where in 1958 they found some human remains from 35,000 years old, and in the process turned many people's theories upside down on the evolution of man. The 3-kilometer walk from the forest camp is through a beautiful forest and concealing a rich cacophony of sounds. The caves are stunningly impressive and extensive, but more so the sand and plank that some 35,000 years ago the beasts were inhabited. The guana is still harvested from the floor of the cave for use as a fertilizer and remains popular on green pepper plantations, I'm told. So for anybody with a green pepper plantation, this is the place to go rather than your normal commercial chemicals. Anyway, but it is the bird nest soup. Excuse me. It is the bird nest soup that basic ingredient. Sorry, it is the bird nest from the swift nest, which fetches up to some $500 a kilo, that is US dollars, when harvested twice a year in October and May. That adds to the fame and importance of these caves. The scaffolding, which we call scaffolding, represents bits of bamboo, stuck, jam, hem, into various crevices in the ceiling of the cave. To prejudge, to climb 100 meters or so up one of these little rickety, shaky bamboo things, to find a little nest, some person prepared to pay a fortune for once it has been cleaned. Going through the caves in the dark, see the various individuals who had made their homes in the caves in this present day and gained a living from the various activities there. Exiting at the back of the cave, a short distance away, is what is referred to as a painted cave, an area to which the modern traveler tourists cannot gain access, unfortunately. The painted cave represented a former burial ground and is by all accounts painted, but perhaps a bit of a disappointment not to be able to get through there. And just to stand and think how 35,000 years, how many lives is that? A long, long time. Miri, S, Miri, M-I-R-I, the next town on the map, was just as interesting as the previous Bintulu. But instead of lumber, its richness is based upon oil, a wonderful temporary commodity of fleeting wealth in this part of the world. I used the stuff here to get the required info on the extensive Mulu Cave, an interesting and popular tourist attraction further inland. The main problem I had with traveling to Mulu is that the largest cave, Sarawak Chamber, the size of some 16 football fields, is not yet open to the public. I saw a little other reason to go see a cave, just for the sake of seeing a large cave. It does in fact help contain the longest freshwater channel underwater cave known to man, some 50 kilometers in total length. But not worth the hassle of getting there. I would prefer a bit more humanitarian interest to the story. On February the 1st, not quite April Fool's Day, I headed off to Brunei. Or more appropriately, in search of a different passport stamp on a brief visit through a certain part of the world before heading on to the neighbouring Sabah, the other province on the East Malaysia. It takes a lot of hassle to get a visa normally from Brunei, unless you hold a British passport, then it is very easy. And it just wasn't worth the hassle to go back to Jakarta, to Kuala Lumpur, to wait a month to actually take such a sense. Anyway, the local story was that maybe I would get a transit visa at the border, so off I headed. It was always worth the risk. And there entered one of life's minor little problems. What happens to people when they get rejected by a country they try to gain access to? Rejected as Brunei by an adamant official who looked as if I was making a mistake by having to reject me. I then wound my way back to the Malaysian border post, told them what had happened. They cancelled the necessary stamps, so now I have a passport stamp marked void, my passport. What a great collection. And then hitched back to Miri. Arriving back in Miri, I found the nearest travel agency was still open. It said, I now have to fly over this country. Could get a bus around, but it takes a couple of days to travel around Brunei by quite a twisty and tortuous route. And all in all, it was easier just to fly. So that evening, I got a plane over the country. I would like to visit. But I would like to visit Brunei, for the sake of visiting Brunei. There is nothing in Brunei other than a business community, very, very overcapacitated buildings of the government nature. February the 2nd, nothing too special about KK, Kota Kinabalu. Kinabalu town, that is. It's an oil-oriented town sprawling along the coastline with little to offer the visitor. The scourge that is next to impossible to get to neighbouring Sulawesi, that part of Indonesia which I would be hoping to visit. This is via the Indonesian consulate. So it never fails to impress me how so many government buildings seem to be the most impressive buildings I've ever seen. Certainly by Indonesian standards, this was a beautiful building, a wonderful architectural design. Stuff in the part of the world that was totally out of place. So now I'm going to the Philippines and then back to Jakarta. Yes, it seems to make far more sense. And anyway, the offer of a special price ticket to the Philippines and return to Jakarta is definitely an offer I could not turn up. It's difficult sometimes to understand the rationale in two neighboring countries, such as Malaysia, as represented in the form of Sarawak and Sabah, and Indonesia, in the form of Kalimantan, also on the island of Borneo, and neighboring Sulawesi. They have so little communication between the two. Certainly the boats and air transport is very minimal. And they don't seem to want to encourage people to travel between the two. Anyway, I can get over these little petty hassles. It's not just my own judgment, in fact. From time to time, the press is starting to hear stories about how they hope to get the relationship between the two countries back onto a more friendly footing. But the fact that they are probably both from Malaysia, Malay-type background, means a bit of stubbornness creeps in, and nobody wants to make the first step. I'm just having some more of my Lipton tea, excuse me. Leaving the quiet town of KK and off along the main road towards the highest mountain in Southeast Asia at just over 4,000 meters. The road carried evidence of various landslides, quite a typical feature in this land of heavy rain. Arrived at the park, which lies at some 1,500 meters, to see the cloud-covered mountain, and in time for a very educational walk through the neighbouring forest. The conductor walked through the trees, which all struggle in competition for the very invasive sunlight, which in turn leaves lower areas quite airy and open. Mosses cover nearly all the damp lower levels, some of which can grow up to 3 feet in height. This is a moss. This is something from Jurassic Park. The park of some 300 square miles, which is quite small by any standards, provides a home to some 1,500 types of orchids, one of which is about one-third the size of the head of a drawing pin, an absolutely beautiful miniature flower examined in close-up. It does pay sometimes either to carry a magnifying glass or to be intensely short-sighted to appreciate the benefits of smaller plants. The forest contains some 40 types of oak trees, which are all part of the wide diversity of flora and fauna, and provide nesting and food for some 300 species of bird. Not bad for such a small park. At evening time, the clouds cleared to allow my first view of the large, imposing mountain. Do I really intend to climb this, I say? Even at this camp, the air is decidedly chillier I'm now writing this point in time, with a sweater over a t-shirt, quite a breakthrough in climate adaptation. The morning dawned early. The morning dawned early and my voice was breaking. As five of the occupants of the road base had recently returned down, and two had already gone out bird spotting, I walked quietly and removed my belongings from the room. A simultaneously beautiful and ugly head of granite from the evening before was silent behind its cloudy mask. Was it brave or frightened of me to find? First in the queue to get through the paperwork and off on stage one. The charge route took me over 1.5 hours and allowed me to climb the first from 1,200 feet to a height of some 6,200 feet. Even the passing minibuses, which took the lazy ones, were down to snail pace on some of those sharp and twisty bends. Stage two started off with a short downward descent, the last descent for a long time before the path started heading up and up. The steps up, like a gigantic natural stairway, were made of wooden pieces backed up by compacted earth, frequently washed away, leaving a man-made obstacle. Stones, tree roots, varying heights from 3 inches to 18 inches, the configuration was relentless and varied. I watched helplessly as one couple raced by at a storming pace. I wondered how big I actually was. It does take a different series of muscles to climb. By the 8,600 foot mark, I came across the same couple trying to recover, taking a smoke break. I felt better. And eventually, my legs allowed me, despite the aches and pains, to reach 10,000 foot mark, by which time there was nothing but rocks making up the route. Through to the huts at 11,000 foot mark, the total summit of some 2,500 feet above. The view was at all times disappointing, with swirling clouds obliterating what one could only imagine. But the real magic joy was in those thousands of different trees and plants. They possessed a rare beauty, with each one composed of differing natural shapes, be it leaves, flowers, stems, buds, shape, texture, smell. It paid dividends and bounty to actually stop to try and smell some of these different plants, as one looked for oxygen in the rarefied air, well, at least increasingly rarefied air. All of these plants seemed blended together without a loss of individuality or identity into that greater beauty of them all. The comparatively low-lying forest gave way nearly abruptly at the 9,000 foot mark to a different vegetation, leaner in tune with the less fertile soil, but equally frequent rainfall level. The pitcher plant is one such example, with varying subspecies from the size of a thimble to larger. It is shaped like a thimble, with the top folded in slightly. From this innocent-looking top and colorful plant, a secretion process takes place, which lures in the unwary insect. The unwary insect pursuing only natural tendencies for nectar. Once inside the rim, it's very difficult for it to escape, and the naturally caught water in the base of the thimble or thimble-shaped plant, the insect falls and drowns. The lower part of the plant then starts to dissolve. Yes, and dissolve, or to extract the proteins and constituent parts of the insect until it is all consumed. Quite a harmless process in many ways, you may say, but remember, the largest recorded pitcher plant contained 4 pints of water and 1 dead rat. So that harmless looking plant can grow into something quite different. Anyway, not the thing to keep next to the bed unless you detest rats. From 10,000 to 11,000 feet mark, the body ached completely. Few overtook me at this stage, in fact none, which says something for me, or something for the rest of them. The rain paid a light but annoying visit at this stage, before I broke through the door of the rest house and collapsed in front of a bowl of Maggie Mee noodle soup, very nutritional value. Twisting the noodles with the chopsticks clasped coldly like belts of steel and chills, tingly jigs the end of my hat, fingers cold, wet. The rain fell gently and coldly outside for most of that evening, awakening in the early morning. The activity before the final climb to 13,450 feet. The wind blew and the rain fell without taking our senses. Clasping a torch, a trickle of climbers headed slowly upwards at 3:30, some half hour later than planned. The weather was using to our fate, the sense of we must get through prevailing. After some 40 minutes, I was the first to turn back. This was crazy, I believe. One slip here in the darkness, and definitely a twisted ligament or ankle was a likely casualty. No sooner had I returned to the comfort, damp comfort of a sleeping bag, than I heard the other people returning. Definitely, I need to have a little bit more experience with my arm, I just think something. Anyway, only a few made it through that morning, and I definitely would not have been amongst them, I think. I'm not that crazy enough to get to the top of a mountain to see nothing but clouds. And no future travelers, get there in dry season when you can see some spectacular sunrises. I, on the other hand, was settled for spectacular sunset. The clouds, when they did break, revealed a beautiful scene lay out below, right down to the coast. Even from the huts, you see 11,000 feet below. Everything seems so small and insignificant. An early morning descent, the rain falling gently from clouds, swirling gently above the path that flowed peacefully, till all was just a rich sword color that is muddy. Muddy sounds dirty to many, but it isn't real. Is it just like something different that we're not used to? Sometimes I wonder if these clouds swirling about, or are they just eternally unhappy about it? But they never remain as one, but they are continuously and restlessly changing shape. Is it an eternal quest for betterment, or the self-satisfaction to rise in perpetual change? Or are the two ambitions linked inevitably and curiously in spirit, but not in form? Just the passing talk, I wonder. Birds, insects, hopping, floating in that early morning surge. The view annoyingly evasive again. The descent rapid and quick, occasionally halting before a fresh entourage of slippery rocks, sticks, and roots. This time the legs hurt just from a different angle. Being able to walk from 25 to 30 kilometers on the flat is of very little use to sharp rises and descents. Sitting back for lunch eventually, I was disappointed the mountain did not say goodbye. Maybe at sunset, maybe never. The night quietly passed and a new phase commenced. The road to Sandakan to the southeast, busy with passenger-laden traffic, in transit under the ever-present early morning mist. I wonder what wrong the mist is trying to wash away. I wonder will I get a bus for space? A lift? From a local who had hitchhiked in the UK. Also included him acting as an informal and casual guide with occasional diversions to see palm oil trees and some various beautiful stops along the way. So we arrived in Sandakan a lot earlier than planned. The former capital of Sabah straddles the coastline, much like KK, and penetrates the inland road for quite a distance. The centre is bustling in anticipation of the Chinese New Year. Its buildings, most of a uniform five-story height, are quite drab in appearance and in definite need of a fresh coat of paint. The popular pastime of billiards and, certainly, amusement arcades, possessed by noisy spirits in air-conditioned comfort, are well catered for. The market, frantic and as ever, in its quest to sell all before the holiday festive season. The hotel, the Wong Hing, with its rooms getting cheaper as one ascends the sixth floor, also pleasantly possessed by festive spirits in its mood. The town, despite all, has team's vantage point, from which Twiz observed is pleasantly industrious pursuit. Very difficult to get a feel of the town, in other words, to see how far we're going to stay.